Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with baseball writers and authors, artists and musicians, filmmakers, basically anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture. Because that's our slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. I hope by the time you hear this, the New York Mets will still be in the World Series. As of this recording, they trail the Kansas City Royals 2-1. But even if they lose the Fall Classic, they have still given their fans a season to remember. One for the books, as the saying goes. One book that might need revising, thanks to Daniel Murphy's record-setting home run, is Numbers Don't Lie, Mets, The Biggest Numbers in Mets History, by Russ Cohn and Adam Rader. I recently spoke with Cohn, who has written several books about baseball and hockey, about the transience of a project like this, where the results and possibilities are always changing. Russ Cohn, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thanks.
Now, I'm probably not the right person to do this because I'm famously terrible at math, so you'll forgive me if I don't understand some of the concepts here. But we are speaking at a good time. I imagine Daniel Murphy's home run streak will appear in the eventual updated edition of the book.
If they ask us for an update, it will certainly be there front and center. Yeah, no question about it.
Well, what was your criteria when picking the numbers that appear in the book?
We, Adam Rader and I, the co-author, we sat down. We were in a lobby of a New York City hotel, and we just sort of started pouring through interesting numbers, and he started just sort of quizzing me, like, what are things that we should have in there? And we both sort of felt like there should be interesting numbers. Like, you could put numbers for anybody, right? And then every Met would probably appear in it. But we were trying to look for, you can't say provocative, but really just sort of interesting ones that you say, wow, I didn't know that, about very well-known guys and sometimes not so well-known guys. And I felt like that would be the key to grabbing the reader's interest.
Now, you have, here we go, is zero technically a number? I don't even know that much. That's how poor my skills are. So you go from zero to 56,188, although you do finish with 42. Now, why is 42 out of sequence like that, and what does it represent?
It's just one of those things. There isn't really a sequence that way. It wasn't done in number order. It wasn't. And so there's just the 42 million reasons you can't forget Bobby Bonilla, because that's what the Mets owe him.
Oh, 42 million. I'm sorry. See, this is what I mean. I should have seen the million part. I just saw.
That's okay, but as we all know, Bobby Bonilla still gets paid by the Mets, and he's been laughing all the way to the bank for quite a few years now.
See, when I saw 42, the first thing that popped into my head was an homage to Jackie Robinson.
Right, so, right.
All right, what didn't make the cut? Can you think of anything that was like borderline that just didn't make it because of either spatial issues or something else?
No, I can't think of anything offhand that way. They didn't give us any real hardcore outline because it was a new book. There's this one and there's one on the Tigers. And so we had pretty good free reign of that. So there really wasn't anything left on the cutting room floor, which in a lot of books there are. This one there wasn't. Did we include everybody from today's roster and everybody who's ever played? No. But there's a really good representation there.
Now, it's funny you say the Tigers. Now, I read once where the baseball book industry is comprised mostly of books about the Yankees, the Cubs, the Red Sox. Why? How did the Tigers get into this mix?
I don't know. You'd have to ask Triumph. But they have a pretty good fan base, and they've been successful up until this year for a good couple of years. So I think maybe they were going with that. They have a great history. I mean, they do.
Now, what was the division of labor between you and Adam?
The division of labor was basically, I'm the more hardcore Met guy. I've got a Met tattoo. And Adam is the more accomplished writer, for sure. We both write. We've written a lot of books. And so we basically, it would sort of start off with me and end up with him. And a lot of times, although he did plenty by himself, too. Don't get me wrong. But that's how a lot of it went, because a lot of times I would just start working on, you know, Dave Kingman. Oh, yeah, Dave Kingman used to strike out a lot, 156 times. Let me do the Dave Kingman, and then Adam would look at it and add, because he's just a tremendous researcher as well. You know, or, you know, Mo Vaughn, same thing for strikeouts, 145 strikeouts. And then you start with Mo Vaughn, and then he perfects it even a little more. It was sort of like that, and it worked well. We've worked well together for – this is our third book together. We had one called 100 Ranger Greats, another one called it's another one about the Rangers, about it's a complicated title, and so I'll just say that it's about all the it's also with Triumph, though.
Now, again, because I'm always interested in the collaboration process, where does Adam live?
He is in Connecticut. He's a Connecticut guy.
Together, face to face, do you correspond by email? Do you get on the phone? How does that process work?
We sat down face to face for the initial. We probably saw each other one other time, maybe two other times while we were writing it. And then we email a lot and call a lot. We do.
And moving on to the graphic portion of the book, because this book is filled with lots of charts and tables, are you involved in that, or you submit the information, the data, and someone at Triumph comes up with, this is the kind of chart we should use for this figure?
They came up with most of the data and charts. If there was something we felt like should be in a chart, then we gave it to them. But most of the time, you know, a good portion of it they came up with on their own and really did a nice job.
Ask, you're happy with the way they presented your information?
Absolutely, yeah. They uncovered a lot of things. There were really some interesting things. You know, there's, you know, as an example, you know, we talked about John Olerud's batting 354, which is tremendous. And then we also talk about the 1999 infield that the Mets had. And so they did a nice graph. Well, really, it's short. It's hard to explain. It's not like a. It's more like a. It's a baseball graph, right? But it's like baseball gloves. Mm-hmm. So what do you call that? Do you call it a chart or a graph?
An infographic, I guess.
An infographic. That's what it is. And so basically, you know, they talk about how in 1999 they only had the whole infield 20 unearned runs allowed, and then the 2012 White Sox had 30, the 1998 Orioles had 31, and the 2010 Padres had 32. So when you see something like that, you say, wow, you know, that really adds to it. And that's pretty nice.
It makes me think of, I don't really read it anymore since it switched over from Baseball Weekly to Sports Weekly, but the USA Today would put out these little infographics back in the 90s and even the late 80s that were just like fascinating representations and made it a little easier to conceive of what raw figures might not.
Yeah, and I remember we definitely suggested a few of them, because I had noticed that, you know, Jose Reyes had 696 at-bats, and the division of his hits was kind of interesting. They, you know, guys with high fielding percentage, Wally Backman in 1985 had 649 chances, and so they made a nice pie chart of the fact that he only made 7 errors, and then he had 370 assists and 272 putouts, and that sort of looks nice. And then, so you see things like that, and it really does sort of help you put into perspective, or at least picture, what the guy's season was like. And so I kind of like that. You know, they'll just, you know, put a guy's stat line, career stat line for the team. They did one, a nice infographic of, you know, Cy Young Award leaders. And so they had, you know, Clemens at the top and Seaver, you know, fifth on the list there.
Which puts it in perspective.
Yeah. And now, again, you know, if I was able to, I would put a nice big asterisk on Clemens, but that's fine.
Well, I mean, he did win the award, you know. So
he did win the award, so I can't do anything about that.
Right.
So, but at least it does. It does help you to put it into perspective. And so when you see things like that, it really does. You know, they have a nice, real nice infographic of, you know, Tom Seaver's career at a glance. Like, that was my favorite player of all time. I was in attendance for his 300th win, even though it was with the White Sox, even though it was at Yankee Stadium. I really enjoyed that day, too, because I was really giving it to some Yankee fans who said that Seaver had no chance of winning. He was an old man, yada, yada, yada. And, you know, of course, he did end up winning. But it really puts things into perspective, because, you know, you see the 311 wins and you say, say to yourself, okay, that's probably never going to happen again. Like, nobody in Major League Baseball is going to get that many wins. So something like that, as far as like a Met, well, that's not his Met total, but just something like that is just a Major League achievement's a big deal, right? And then you look at even his strikeouts, 3,640, that's a tough number to get nowadays. Will somebody? Maybe. 656 games, 647 starts, and you forget that he did come in relief in some games. And 231 complete games, I'm pretty positive that will never happen again for any Major League pitcher.
Well, one of the things I said in last night's coverage of the pennant clinching game of the Mets versus Cubs was that they were comparing Bartolo Colon, and right now I'm blanking out on either it was DeGrom or Syndergaard,
right,
and saying that what Colon has accomplished in his career and how he's pitching at 42 and how they doubt anyone, either of those two guys I mentioned, would be pitching at that age.
Yeah, it's conjecture, and it's probably true. I don't know if it matters much. I mean, I have a website called Sportsology, and I just wrote an article about Noah Syndergaard because, you know, Noah Syndergaard to me reminds me of a young Nolan Ryan. He's striking guys out at that pace. He's not purely perfected yet where you have to sort of watch him in a game and you see Terry Collins will pull him just at the right time. Maybe it's 5 1/3 innings. Maybe it's 6 1/3, not much after that. But at that point, he might already have 13 strikeouts. And he has 20 strikeouts in around 13 innings in the postseason. So he's really dominant. And, you know, when people with the Cubs kept saying, well, we have Jake Arrieta, you know, the natural knee-jerk is to say, well, you know, DeGrom is the Mets ace. They have him. And Harvey is Harvey. But I would say, hey, we have, you know, Mets have Syndergaard. I mean, that's a guy who right now is really hard to hit, like almost impossible. And he's throwing, you know, faster than anybody as far as per pitch in Major League Baseball. So I don't know if that will be the case. Nolan Ryan went for a long time, so we'll see. But that's my comparison, you know.
Now, you mentioned his 13 strikeouts. One of the biggest, and I hesitate to use the word problems, because there are a lot, the famous saying, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. The chapter you have on Harvey's 11 strikeouts in his debut, there is a big pie chart, takes up the whole page, I think, breaking down the pitches that he threw for strikes. And the basic information is that he threw 106 pitches and 65 were for strikes. Well, that means 41 weren't for strikes. So when you break it down like that, it's just... You know, again, math here, my weak subject, but that's not a whole lot more than 50%. So if you say it like that, it doesn't seem like that big a deal.
No, you're right. You're right. But I'll tell you the part that makes a lot of sense. The two columns that get looked upon, like in Sandy Alderson's office and a lot of GM's offices, is strikes looking and strikes swinging. Because nowadays... You know, the strikes by contact, it's still nice that it's a strike, but there's contact. Nowadays, they're looking for the least amount of contact possible. So he did have 33 pitches where there was no contact. So was that strike three? Was it strike two? You know, you don't know. Did a guy strike out looking? I imagine there were a few crooked Ks in there. So that's important.
But the strikes for contact also include the balls that were hit for outs.
Yes. Yep. That's why I'm not as high on that part as the other two. But again, if you got 33 of them out of 106 were either swinging strikes or looking strikes, you figure he had a pretty good game. You could tell just by that.
Okay, see, when you explain it like that, it makes perfect sense.
Yep.
So I want to switch gears just a little bit now because you have written about other sports. So... What is, do you think, is the main difference between writing about a slow sport like baseball and an extremely fast sport like hockey?
What's the difference? Well, the first thing is the title. I'm going to say it now because I have it in front of me because I fanned on that before. It's 100 Things Ranger Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. Very complicated title, but a fun book. But the difference is baseball, while we think of it as a slower-moving sport, and it is, right? Hockey is probably the fastest-moving sport on Earth. The difference is that baseball is mental. And it's hard sometimes to tell, like, a younger person, a 20-year-old, if you don't play, and I still play. I play softball. And and a lot of times I'm playing first base or third base. And so I'm doing a lot of thinking, right? And you probably, when you played, if you played, did a lot of thinking before the ball ever got to you, right? If there's a guy on base, ball's hit to third, what am I going to do? Am I throwing to second? Am I going to first? What am I doing with it? Two men on base, am I going to step on the bag first, then am I going to second, or am I going to first? Those kinds of things, to me, make baseball very interesting. So, like, when I watch a game, I sometimes, and maybe it drives my wife crazy, maybe it doesn't, will predict sometimes the pitch that will come out of the pitcher's hand. Hey, he's got two strikes, I think he's going to throw a curveball here, he's not going to go with the fastball. Those kinds of things keep me in the game and make it very exciting rather than boring. Where hockey, it's all action all the time. It's right in front of you. There's hits, there's shots, there's saves. So it is different in that regard, and there is a mental aspect to hockey, as Wayne Gretzky pointed out many years ago, but baseball is definitely more mental. I don't want to sound like Yogi with this, but it is.
Okay, that's fine from a fan's point of view, but from a writer's point of view.
From a writer's point of view, baseball's got a steeper tradition in this country, so it's more ingrained first in my brain. While I love both sports equally, I always knew more about baseball than hockey. I was a hockey fan after. Like, 1972 was my first start for hockey. We're 68. As a five-year-old, you know, we're into baseball. I was talking to my grandfather already about baseball. Like, that was, we had a crazy baseball household. Used to go to every doubleheader. Drove my mother and my grandmother crazy at Shea Stadium. They'd have food waiting, and sometimes we get home at 5 o'clock. Sometimes you get home at 6 o'clock. Sometimes you get home at 6:30. Like, then, you know, there was no cell phone. You couldn't,
right.
You couldn't call ahead. So they had to watch the game to figure out when to make the food to know when we'd be home, right? It was all guesswork. But baseball has tremendous statistics still, the ones that aren't marred by the steroid era. So I think that's a big advantage that it has over hockey, where hockey, I have a bit more action that I could write about and draw upon. Baseball has the action, but the action isn't as great. So then with baseball, you have to sort of rely on your statistics more and your history more, where hockey, you can rely on more of the action and then mix in the history and the stats.
We've been talking with Russ Cohen, author of Numbers Don't Lie for the Mets, the biggest numbers in New York Mets history, written with Adam Rader. Russ, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Hey, Ron, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
And that was our baseball bookshelf conversation with Russ Cohen. Tune in again next time and we'll have another interesting guest from the world of baseball pop culture. In the meantime, please visit Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews on the national pastime. And remember, if you have any kind of questions or concerns or answers, please send them to ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you next time.
Pitching that fader so grand, he'd have said, "Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land."